Somehow you can't find God until you first contract a hepatitis or dysentery. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it just says in the chapter to the agnostic, deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It's only there that it can be found, the great reality. There is no other reality. Everything else is perception. You know, perception is the snail sitting on a turtle going, wee, you know. You know, it doesn't make it real. What's real is real. The rest of this stuff is just made up. And the reality of my life had always been that I thought my perception was reality. And subsequently, I couldn't understand why the lessers that I was integrating with didn't understand that. I mean, I had a wife that was so normal, it was scary. You notice the word had. You know, and we would have these conversations where she was in the plane of reality and I was doing drive-bys. And she would say things like, there's somebody outside. And my response was, good, that's where they belong, outside. You know, like, that's why we have an outside. When they come inside, you know, wake me up. They shouldn't be inside. And I remember a night in particular, she woke me up and said, I had this terrible dream. And I said, what was it? She said that you took me to the desert and you left me there. And I said, look, if you let me go back to sleep, I promise to pick you up first thing in the morning. You know, that was where I was at. I came home and said, you know, I'm very depressed, and I started to drink a lot of alcohol. And she said, what are you doing? I said, the market had its worst down day in the history of the market. And she looked at me as someone totally in reality and said, we don't have any stock. You can't argue with someone like that. They are so grounded in what's really going on when you're doing these Buzzley Berkeley drive-bys that, you know. And that's why when I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and got into reading about our guy, St. Francis. St. Francis was a guy who had the lotto given to him. His dad was going to turn over armies and empires. It's not like, well, if I ever won the lotto, I'd do this. Francis won the lotto. And his dad said to him, you know, here's everything you need. You're going to become this huge, huge man in this area. And his response to that was to take off the clothes he was wearing and say to his father, I'm not ever going to do that. And his father said, well, I'm your father and you will do that. And as he completely disrobed down to his undergarments and took off his shoes, he said, from this point forward, the only father I have is in heaven, and I am going to go and be a fool for God. And he walked away from that. He walked away from it. And Francis dedicated his life on three basic legacies. You know, he wanted to be poor, hungry, and homeless. Try to get leverage on a guy like that. You know. So what do you want out of life, Fran? I want to be poor, hungry, and homeless.
We'd have to go for sex.
Yeah. Yeah. Your mind's coming back. The Chevy just got a tune-up. I remember the words, if I only knew the application. I mean, this is it. But that's the deal. That was Francis's deal. And I read a little quote by his, which meant a lot to me at the time because I had just given away everything I owned several months back because I wanted something simple. I didn't like the way my life was going, so I made a very significant change. I just walked away from the job I had, and I gave up everything I owned. And it's, as I said, I put it in the car and I left. And when I read this down there, and of course they didn't, he wanted to be humble, so of course the powers that be built a cathedral in Santa Fe and named it after him. You know, most ornate thing you could have. And he wrote in one of his writings, which was, as I said, hit me, he said, as I look back on my life, The thing I notice with the greatest clarity is that by having no possessions, I had no earthly attachments. By having no possessions, I had no commitment to keeping a look that I did not want to bear. This guy somehow got very insightful. We read that prayer of St. Francis and we think he just walked into this thing. His life was very tormented. For years, he lived a very, very tormented life before he made that contact. And his prayer used to be, "Who art thou, Lord? And who am I, your unworthy servant?" When he got to the prayer that we use in our literature, he had paid a price in his life. And that price was the price of walking away from the familiar, the comfortable, the knowable, and going out and being a fool for God. And being a fool for God, folks, is not really in vogue. To talk about it is one thing. To actually do it is something else. The TV is full of people who talk about it. But very few people want to do it because doing it involves going against things that we think are very important. And when, as I said, one of the gifts of life I've had is death. And death hasn't made me morbid at all. It's made me more attuned to how important each day is. Because when you're down to that point where the final days are there, you ask yourself questions like, where am I going? I don't know what language I'm going to need. My passport is of no value. Whether I have the gold card or the platinum card doesn't count. Whether I've been successful monetarily or non-successful doesn't. In other words, you begin to really see what your assets are. If you're doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as prescribed in the big book, you've got a leg up because you're doing a lot of service work and you're at least attempting to maintain a contact with this higher power. So we're already in the game, so it shouldn't come as a bigger shock for us at the end. We already know the players. In Alcoholics Anonymous, by taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was given a wonderful gift. Instead of sitting in the audience being intimidated by the play, I got to go backstage to see where the noise came from. I got a chance to look behind the curtain and see what was going on. When I went through those steps with my sponsor, I did literally die. The person I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous could not stay sober, could not live a decent life, didn't understand the true sense between right and wrong. I had perceptions, but I didn't know. And by taking the steps, just as they're outlined there, what happened to me was I was exposed to myself because I was evicted from my hiding places. I had been very good from hiding from myself. And those steps put me in such a posture that I had no place to go. I was completely exposed. And from that point forward, I had something to work with that was real, because that's who I was.
And I don't know if Ken will agree with the words I use, but I had that same experience of surrender, and he said the man that came to Alcoholics Anonymous could not stay sober, that man died. But my ego came back, and it caused great mischief over the next period of time. And at 7 or 8 years, I became at another significant crisis, and I had another surrender at depth that I had to make. And I think that that is part of what happens, is that you don't just learn at once. That you learn at once. The ego does not die. You have a clearing in which that happens. But if you don't maintain that clearing, the weeds start to grow back, and it can become kind of a jungle. And I think that that's what happened to me. And I think that the understanding that I had at 1 or 2 years of sobriety was not sufficient understanding for me at 7 or 8 years of sobriety. And I had to come to a deeper, even though I've been trying to deepen that understanding, and maybe to some degree did deepen it over a period of time, something of significance happened to me. And I think that, again, in my experience, most of the people that I know who are alcoholics, somewhere between 5 and 12 years, give or take, have kind of a second crisis in their lives. That they're early understand, we come in with an idea of what we want to accomplish with our sobriety, For many of us, it's very concrete and kind of physical. We have a surrender. We get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And many of us are extraordinarily successful at accomplishing those things in our early sobriety. But there's a lot of things that were never on our list that need attending to, that are out of control and out of balance, that are not okay in our homes and in our work lives and in our society. And that if we don't start having to deal with those things, which most of us do, that we drag some significant issues into our recovery and do not have enough consciousness to have jettisoned them. And I think the process of recovery is a process of waking up, and you wake up enough, and one by one, those things almost fall off us. That the process of change may not be so much one of muscle and one of resistance, as Ken talked about, because when we use our mind for resistance, you don't resist, because when you resist, you actually bind yourself to the thing that you're trying to resist. It is one of letting go. It is one of surrender. And when we wake up, as we become more awake, an awake person does things differently than a person who is asleep, and some of those things just fall off. They no longer are part of who we are or what we do. And we may describe that process like change. And maybe we get to a point where we are so entirely ready to have God remove it that we are then at a point in time where it is removable. And it is removed. Because we at that point in time are a clearing. We are not in charge of that process.
They're meeting. You know, one of the great things that has come to me in sobriety, among many things, is I now have no fear of things that I used to have a lot of fear of. And one of the things I was terribly afraid of in my life were dogs. And it seemed to me early on in my life I was bitten several times trying to get into places that they were paid to keep you out of. And so I developed this fear of dogs. And several years ago I was driving down a street in San Diego, side street, and it was a very hot day. It was about 100, 105. And I looked in my rearview mirror, and here was this Rottweiler bearing down on my car. And, you know, it's a huge dog. It's like a Doberman on steroids. It's a big animal. And I intuitively knew what to do. I pulled over to the side of the road, and I let that dog catch up with me. And I put down my window, and I looked at that dog, and that dog looked at me, and I said to that dog, "What now?" And that dog looked at me, and I looked at it, and just for that moment, we were on the same wavelength. Because that dog knew I had chased after a lot of shit in my life, having no idea what I was going to do if I ever caught it. And we had this instant identification. And we just kind of hung there for a second, him checking me out, me checking him out. And then I let him catch his breath a little bit because he was kind of slobbering. And I told him to hang in there. Maybe a Volkswagen would come along. And when I pulled away, you know, I can't say for sure, but I think the dog waved. You know, like, and that's simply because when you're there in the moment, those things happen. They just happen. I've learned that there's three things that I can't change in life, and one is the past. I can't change the past. And I can't change the truth, and I can't change another person. And if I keep clear of trying to change those things, my days become pretty restful. My days are very cantankerous and confused and frustrated when I'm trying to change things that I'm not supposed to change, nor am I empowered to change. And life gets pretty easy. You know, it gets pretty easy. I watch football, and I don't know if you folks like football, but in football, there's a thing called a punt returner. And I think alcoholics are punt returners. You know, it's a dangerous part of the game, and you have to run down the field with the ball with large people trying to knock you down. And I think after you're here, my experience has been I'm a punt returner. But I've been here long enough that I never get hit anymore because I fair catch everything. You know, as soon as that ball's in the air, I don't care where the big guys are. I'm fair catcher. And then as soon as I get the ball safely tucked in my hand without getting hurt, you know, I'll hand it to a newcomer. And we'll watch him maneuver a little bit, you know, like say, look, I got the tough yardage out to the 20. You do the rest of the job. I'm not that age anymore where I just don't want to take the hits. I just don't want to take the hits. I'm at ease with life. I'm good to go. I scare people sometimes because they think you're talking suicidal. I'm not talking suicidal. It's not depression. I enjoy life to the utmost. But if somehow I were to find out it's over, it would be over. You know, that's just the way it is. And once you have that, it's not what St. Francis had, but it's a taste, it's a flavor of what he had. And I believe that as you get more and more comfortable with that, the flavor gets stronger. And once you realize that you have that taste in your mouth, you can't get it out. It's ingrained, it's a part of you. And the end result is people no longer have the control they once had. I used to spend, I can't tell you, nights laying awake, looking at the ceiling, working out chapters of my life. Financially, I'd be carrying numbers from one side of the ceiling to the other. How am I going to make this work? And everybody else would be sleeping. And in the morning, they'd get up real refreshed, and somehow I always looked tired. And the reason was I was tired. I was spiritually tired. I was using up all the energy that I had to work out phantom problems, most of which never happened. About 98% of the stuff that I thought would happen never happened, and the rest of it happened so fast I never had time to think about it. And that's the way it's been, you know. And what we're doing here today, this is like feeding a child, you know. When you start out feeding a child, you give them the pablum. They're not ready for T-bone steak. And you got to be fed on what you can absorb. So if you're here and you feel like some of this is over your head, just chalk it off to, you know, bad presentation. You know, and realize that what you're supposed to get out of this, you're getting. You may not be aware of it at the time, but you're getting it. And the rest of this stuff is, if you need it, take it in. And if you can use it, use it. But as is mentioned in the literature, this is an individual adventure. You know, your sponsor can't do this for you. The group can't do it for you. AA can't do it for you. It's an individual adventure. You're going to have to go out there and get your own shots. And in getting those shots, you'll come to your own reality, whatever that is. No one else can do it for you. I can fair catch and hand you the ball, but now it's yours.
But you can get a guide. A couple of years ago, I went elk hunting with my sponsor. My sponsor just had 48 years of sobriety, Warren. And we went to a place where you paid quite a bit of money, and it was 600,000 acres of land. And when you pay a fair amount of money to hunt, and you would like to find something, one of the things you really need is a guide. I had very little background or information that would make me well equipped to go on that piece of property myself and try to find what I was hunting. And it's extraordinary when you find a guide and you're really interested in it, that person, you know, your interaction and the conversations you have with that person are very different. You can have many of those conversations in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's important, and there are people who you can get to help you in your spiritual walk, in your AA walk, your sponsor. They don't have to be perfect people. If you're really an interested traveler, you're just talking, we're all travelers. We're talking about traveling. What are you doing? We're stimulating each other. It isn't like you have to find the perfect person. They don't have the perfect person. But you're going to want a guide. And you're going to want a relationship with fellow travelers. You're going to want to get together after the evening meal is over and sit around and BS about how your travel is going. And it is extraordinary. I mean, it really, if you're really going to be a traveler and you're really interested in it, you're going to want that camaraderie. You're going to want the help. You're going to want the advice. And then you're going to want the sharing, because something will come out in that process of the sharing. And you need a practice. You need a village. You need a community in which to have this unfold and take place. And that's what we are for each other. There's something, this is, everything we do is together. You know, right now we're talking and you're listening, but we're creating, whatever is being created here today is being created together. I promise you, we didn't know what we were going to do when we sat down. And if we sat down with a different group and if we went to Indiana to do this thing, what we would be saying would be considerably different. There would be parts of it that would be similar, but there is something in the permission and in the interaction that we are together that allows us to have this conversation. This conversation is not just our words. This conversation is permitted by your listening. The words we are speaking are the ones that are permitted. And if you don't believe that, remember the last time you gave a talk at a detox. Because it is harder. There is not the listening. There is not the reception. So there is, you know, two things going on, you know, that are very special. We got 5 more minutes, 2 more minutes.
You know, someone sent me, you guys, this is just some information, you may know it already, but somebody sent me a clipping from one of the New York newspapers and about the chaplain who was killed and carried out by the firemen there in New York. I think his name was Father Michael. And Father Michael was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the day that his funeral took place, he was 23 years sober. And when the building was coming down, the other firemen knew they could get him out, and they asked him to leave. And he supposedly responded with, "Why? The men are here." And so the reality of life is it's doing the thing that you know you have to do, regardless of the risk you have to take. And then when you do those kind of things in life, when you put yourself in harm's way for another person, or you do something that extends you, God's got the game rigged. He plays a rigged game. It's not a fair game. And what he does is every time you help somebody else, in some way or another, he helps you to be a better person. And you just can't lose. The more you give, the more you get. It's a darndest game. And I learned that game when I was running numbers from a guy who was, there wasn't a mafia, but if there was, he would have been in it. And I remember going to him and saying, "Tony," because I had heard in school that about God, I said, "Do you believe in this God thing?" And he said, "Why?" And I said, they were talking about the devil today. And I didn't know about the devil. And what he told me was very interesting. He said, "Ken, do we ever lose when we take book? And I said, "Well, every now and again somebody hits." Or, No. "Do we ever lose?" is the question. And the answer is no. The money spread, we never lose. And he said, "Do you think God would make a game he lost at?" And it hit me, no, God wouldn't make a game he lost at. And as I've gotten to the point I'm at today, I can tell you, whether you accept it or not, doesn't matter. But I know this. I know this from the depth of my being, that God is in such hot, hot pursuit of all of us that none of us get away. Absolutely none. He's just in such hot pursuit. Sometimes you don't even know it, but that's his deal. He likes to be anonymous. But he's not going to let anybody get away. And the reality of that is that eventually you'll touch on this thing, whether it's now, later, or whenever. I don't know what happens next, but I know in the now, the presence of God. You notice it says, as we become conscious of his presence, it doesn't say when he shows up. So God is always there. It's just a matter of being in touch. And I start the day most of the time by doing stupid things. I used to have a trampoline when my knees were good, and I used to put on the theme from Rocky. And I used to jump up and down in a full-length mirror nude on a little trampoline I had. That's what it did to me, too. You know, the same thing you're doing. And it would get me in such a good frame of mind that I could go out and face anything. You know, like, I mean, I figure, how really could I be serious having just witnessed what I witnessed? You know? And so the bottom line is that that's the deal here. You know, you have to really see, sooner or later, if you're lucky, you come to the to the reality that this is all a joke, and we're the punchline. And if you don't get the joke, then you miss out on the best punchline. And just remember, if you don't hear anything else from me today, God is in such hot pursuit, you're just not going to get away.
Cool. If we undertake having a spiritual awakening on our own, what kind of results can we expect? Do we always need guidance, such as a sponsor, or can we get positive results on our own?
You're not supposed to fix the broken tool. You're supposed to get a new tool. This isn't about changing the furniture. This is moving out of the house. You know, don't try to fix it. Just leave it alone. Go on to the thing you should be doing. And yes, everybody needs somebody. Somebody was pointing out to me that Tiger Woods has a coach and Joe Montana has a coach. And, you know, you need someone. And fortunately, there's a lot of good people out there in AA who you can sit down with. I'm always amazed that in our literature, it talks specifically to the fact that in the beginning of AA, you know, way back when we weren't so slick, they used to set aside one evening for spiritual guidance and answering of questions. And I don't know of too many groups, they have beginners meetings, but that's more about orientation. I don't know too many groups that really have an evening or a day meeting set aside where they just do spiritual orientation. But yes, you do.
And I don't think your tool's busted. Your perception of it may be that it's busted. I don't think you have to do anything. The fact is we are the pipe. We're not the well. It happens through us, not by us. All we have to do is start accessing the Spirit and seeking God, and I believe that we will be transformed in that process. How did you develop a solid idea of who your higher power is, and how do you make your higher power bigger? I don't think you can make a higher power bigger. Plenty big to start with. I've developed the idea of who my higher power is over the last 34 years. I've developed it in taking the steps. I've developed it in a conversation with my teachers in the program. I've developed it by going to conferences. I've developed it by reading. I've developed it by going to retreats. I've developed it by encouraging the interest that I have in knowing who my God is. And I think that's all you have to do is to take the kernel of that and feed it. And your journey will pull you along.
I was spurred on initially by Bill Wilson's story, his Winchester Cathedral experience, where he said when he really asked for God and needed God and wanted God to come, he did. And then he said something even almost as profound as that. He said, unfortunately, he was quickly moved out of that moment by the clamor, by worldly clamors, most of which came from within. And those, again, not being scarred by education, I looked up the word clamor, and it means continuous noise is a clamor. And think of how far we've come from when Bill was around to how many clamors there are today in this techno-barbaric world. Bells, whistles, phones. This new millennium, the Holy Grail, is going to be silence.
One of these seems to be more of a comment. Why do we give this up? Serenity, peace, and love so easily. I take that to be more of a statement than a question. And it's a good question, one that we could all ask ourselves. Next question. I get confused by the polarity of talking all the time. I need to learn and love, paired with the idea of living in the now because I could die tomorrow. It seems like these are two different ways to live. Are there ways to combine them harmoniously? I get confused by the polarity of talking all the time. I need to learn and love, paired with the idea that I may die. I think life is a paradox. I think both those things are true. I think you have to live with the awareness that life is impermanent. I think the last, I'm 50, I'll be 59 next month. I think I'm obviously in the last quartile or last 10 or 20 years of my life, probably. I think the last segment of your life is dealing with your mortality. And bit by bit, you lose the things that you are attached to, whether it's your sexuality, your athleticism, your business, your, you know, one by one by one, the world starts to reduce the things. And what you are left with, I believe, and I, with probably even having a comment on it with all Ken's experience with dying, but I think there is a sparseness, a cleanness, a singularity. There is a stripping away, and at the moment of death, I don't think almost anything that we are concerned about is of any matter at all. One of the things I've been blessed with in my travels in sobriety is I've been blessed with teachers. I wanted to be a teacher, that I've been attracted to the men and women who are kind of teachers. And I think if you got the wisest, oldest men and women on the front porch in one of those big old southern places, and you went to them and you just wanted to be with them, and you got a cup of coffee and you sat down in the rocking chair, I think they'd all pat us on the head and just say, "It's okay. It doesn't matter. It's okay." That so much of the stuff that just drove us nuts and we were worried about doesn't matter, and it is okay. Life is okay just the way it is. You don't have to mess with it, and you don't have to worry about it. But I think simultaneously you have to play full out. I think you have to be in the game. I think you have to try to be a lover. I think that each of us have special gifts. Each of us are a special unfolding of God's consciousness. I think the price of not being connected to God, the price of not having recovery, the price of not being well is never getting to be who you are. In addition to being the essence of God, in addition to being that special spark, we are also a human expression of God. And that each of us has a particular pitch that we play when the wind of God blows through us, and it is a special gift. And I think when we are allowed to play that tune, to hear that note, our life, in those moments, we are as full as we have ever been. Most of us with the pathology of alcoholism, and to our saying no to certain aspects of our recovery, impede, and sometimes we never get that gift out of the box. It is still under the piano with the bow on it. That's a tremendous price to pay, that you never got a chance to be Ken, or you never got a chance to be Bob.
One of the great mystics in days of yore wrote an article in which he said, through each one of us, God is trying to become something he has never been before, and we impede him. We impede him by trying to dig our heels in and maintain our own identity. And it's not until we are willing to surrender that identity to the all that we become the all. You know, the healing process is love. And love, as I said before, is the strongest force in the world. And it's not about loving with conditions. It's just loving. It takes pure love to recognize the fact that everyone is entitled to be who they are, even if I don't agree with them. And there was a play downtown in San Diego, just finished running, ran for a year and a half, and it was called "I Love You Just the Way You Are, Now Change."
One of the last questions is, what are some of the practices to stay in the now more often? There's a powerful book which is called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. It is a very interesting book. It's a book about consciousness. It's a book about ego, and it's a book about obsessive thinking. It's a book about the modern mind, and it's a book about God. And I think it's a very interesting book. I think that as we go through our recovery and as we go to events like we're having today, you walk away with one or two thoughts or ideas. One of the thoughts you may walk away with is just that maybe before we walked in this room, this idea about how do you stay in the now would never have been a question in your mind. That is a question in your mind today because of the conversation we've had in this room. Okay? if you go to other rooms like this, and you go to other meetings, and you are open, and you listen, you will get other encouragements and other ideas about how to do it. I think the best way to do it is to know that you are not your mind and you are not your thinking. And when you don't so closely identify with your mind, you have an opportunity that you have not had before to be in the now. It is thinking that will take you to the past and project you to the future. It is being able to watch your mind start to do that and let it go. A friend of mine said you have a Grand Central Station mind. You do not have to get on every train that goes through the station. Okay. And that most of the old masters would talk about letting the trains go through. Letting the thoughts are like clouds in the sky, just let them go through. You do not have to, interact with and that's the freedom we're talking about.
I like to use a lot of practical things because I'm a pretty practical person. And one of the things I use as an everyday reminder is every time my phone rings, I never pick it up on the first two rings. As soon as I hear the phone ring, I say, "Thank you, Lord, for keeping me sober today. Please keep me awake to your wish." And instead, I pick the phone up. I'm usually a much better conversationalist then. And the same way at red lights, when I stop at red lights, I pretty much say the same thing. Lord, keep me sober today, and thank you for all your gifts. And this constantly reminds me to stay in the moment, and it constantly reminds me that I'm not in charge.
How do you work through or walk through phantom fears? Phantom fears to me are other people's fears. Mine are all real. Fear is something that happens in thinking. For the last 6 weeks, I have had a pretty good-sized business deal that I very much wanted to go a certain way. And it has fallen out of bed 7 or 8 times in the last 6 weeks. And maybe for one of the first times in my adult life, and it's important to me, it could make a difference in the financial stability of my life. But it's not a small deal. And I think I had more freedom to have it happen and then not happen, happen and not happen. Now, I did ask my wife to pray that what was supposed to happen, happened. My wife is one of the better prayers around. You'd have to be being married to me. I have been almost a constant source of growth for her. But I was startled. Sometimes I forget. I've been doing this for 34 years. And it's important to me. I really try. I don't do it all the time. But I do it pretty often. And I was freer than I have been, maybe at any other point in my life, to have it not happen and happen and not happen and happen and not happen and happen. And I thought, that's really freedom. And I promise you, whoever asked this question, that, 10 years ago, when I wanted to go talk to Ken about it, I mean, the fear that I would have had around that would have been just extraordinary. I would have been having hours of conversation about that with my sponsor and with my partner. I would have been talking about it endlessly. And one of the freedoms I have today is I have more freedom to have something happen when it's really happening and have it not happen when it's not happening. And the fact is that there were probably only about 2 hours in the last 2 months that I needed to interact around that issue. And that most of all the other times that it popped up in my mind, it wasn't happening. It was just a thought. And I could have spent 200 hours talking about what if in that process, and I don't think I spent 2 hours. And that is like being let out of jail.
When I first read the book, Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read we're driven by 100 forms of fear, I thought it was just another exaggeration. And I thought these guys who wrote this book really needed help. And since I've been here, if anything, they probably underestimated the number. Because fear, the fear that we're talking about now, is, it talks in the big book, it says, fear is an evil and corroding thread, and our fabric is shot through with it. We're just shot through with fear. We're constantly in fear. And that's because we're not comfortable with who we are and what's going on around us, obviously. The other thing was, in the 12 and 12, it says, we feel that freedom from fear is more important than freedom from want. Fear that they talk about here, the phantom fear, obviously doesn't exist. And if something doesn't exist, then you can't do anything about it. And it's a terrible burden to be in a scenario trying to do something about something that doesn't exist and you can't do anything about it. It seems to take a toll on people, you know. The reality of life is the reality of life. What is, and what is not. And the simplicity of life is to know, you know, it says to be or not to be. And what I found out is the only way to be is not to be. And when you get to the point where it just doesn't matter which way it goes. We have a gentleman who passed away in our area. He was sober 39 years, got sober at 50, and died at 89. And he's one of my heroes in AA. His simplicity was amazing to me. And one day at a meeting, they were talking about fear and making a decision, and Lewis went up, and Lewis cleaned the cells at the county jail, and he used to wear these flood pants and high work boots and one suspender on and one suspender off. And he always got up and said the same thing. My name is Lewis, and I come here because I'm trying to stay sober. And he'd go up, and they talked about this fear and decision. And Lewis reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a silver dollar, and he flipped it. And he said, heads, I'll do it this way. Tails, I'll do it that way. It doesn't matter. I'm 39 years sober. I can live with it either way. And when you can live with it either way, that's an amazing thing. He also had a deal with the Reader's Digest one day where he was looking at the word vocabulary, the power vocabulary, and then turning to the back and putting down the answer, looking at the answer. And one of the newcomers who had like 8 or 10 years said to him, Lewis, that's not the way it's supposed to work. It's a multiple choice. You're supposed to guess which one it is and then check your answers in the back. And Lewis looked at him, he said, why would I guess if I know where the answer is?
Patty, do you want us to do anything? Do you want us to wind up, or? One unshared thought I've had this weekend is I have the same feeling a little bit when I'm around Ken. It's intimidating, his freedom that he has around materialism. I am a very materialistic person. I do not have the freedom around material things that Ken has. One of my biggest fears is that God would make me happy and poor. And yet I'm convinced that there are major lessons for me. I've already had significant lessons. But it is interesting. And when I listen to you talk, I both am very attracted to what I hear and somewhat intimidated by your freedom in that area. I never expected AA to be what it was. I expected AA to be a way not to drink. And I got an AA, and I found out that there was a program that dealt with physical but also mental and spiritual, and that AA was a way to live. That the steps were the program. And that if I applied those principles in my life, and I would be changed in such a way that, first of all, I would not have to drink. Pretty profound change in itself. And that secondly, as those principles seeped into the core of my life, that my life would change and my experience in that life would change, and that a lot, awful lot of the negative things that I was doing and the defects of character and the consequences of those defects of character would be reduced and my life would start to alter, and the implication would be that it would alter for the better. I've always wanted to arrive. I've wanted to arrive in my business life. I wanted to arrive athletically, sexually, financially, AA-wise, you know, become a big deal in AA. Never have. I think one of the things about life as you get older is, when they talk about midlife crisis, the midlife crisis is that you get, as your life starts to get towards this last quartile, and you take a look, you realize that many of the mountains you wanted to climb, you're not going to climb. And that many of the mountains you have climbed didn't matter. And that many of the things you thought were so damn important weren't important at all. And some of the things that you didn't think were important were awfully important. Family becomes more important. Love becomes more important. Being right becomes less important. Wanting to know who I am and what it's all about probably becomes the most important of all. Today, if I were to report on the idea, over the last 15 years, the biggest idea I've had is how reluctant to change I am. That has been maybe the theme of my, kind of the focus of my recovery. Today, I have been holding a thought for the last couple of years that is starting to excite me, and that is that my higher power and the God of my understanding is who I am. I used to be worried that if I turned myself over to God, he'd send me to China. You know, that idea that I'd be a missionary, or I'd, you know, never get laid again or something. But, I mean, there'd be, but there'd be something that if I turned, you know, that God would not want me to have any fun, or that, at any rate, that the process of turning myself over to God would be a restriction. I mean, I clearly had that. That's an old idea. And I'm starting to have a sense that the God of my understanding is me. That there is a part of me that is God. That I am not, may not be all that God is, but there is a part of me that is comprised of God. And that is my higher power. And in that place, there's no conflict between what that power wants for me and me. It is me. And that it is my connection with that power that, rather than being restrictive, would be the fulfilling of my life. That by almost by definition, it could not be restrictive. And that almost by definition, it would be fulfilling. And that everybody who would be connected to me in my life, my wife and our three boys and my partner and my, that it would be the my turning my will and my life over to that power and being as clear a channel as possible for that power to express itself in my life would be the best act of love for anybody that was connected to me in any way.
Well, I want to thank Patty and the group for inviting me, and Cynthia and Tom for coming out and picking me up, and I enjoyed being with Bob. And Bob is a guy of extremes, as you know. Going to China or getting laid again. I mean, that's a. I mean, you. I mean, I watched the meter go way over on that. I always like sick people. And the reason being is that I closely identify. And but this has been a good weekend, as all weekends are that end in this kind of a thing for me. You know, I had a brother and a sister who died a week apart. One died Christmas Day of 85, and another one died, my brother died New Year's Day of 86. And my mom died shortly after that because she just didn't understand why kids should die before the parents. And outside of my mom, they all died from alcoholism, cirrhosis. And the bottom line is that going out to the cemetery, I'm a visual person, and I went out to the cemetery and I saw the headstones, and the headstone, every headstone looks exactly alike. It has your name at the top, it has a dash of about 6 inches, and then it has the date you died. And that dash, which is never more than 6 to 8 inches on any headstone, is life. It's the dash. And I'm older than Bob, so I'm a little bit further along in the dash. And the reality is I don't have time to waste trying to figure out things. I don't have time for resentment. I don't have time for anger. I don't have time for what should have been done and wasn't done, or was done and shouldn't have been done. Today, I'm going to live my life totally in the moment, and I'm not going to let anybody else dictate how I live my life. I'm going to live it as simply as I can. And by not having any agenda in that area, I have the best agenda. And life is very simple. You know, this is a real tough thing, being an earthling. And we have to take really good care of one another, because we're only on loan. And someone who's in your life today may not be there tomorrow, so you can't leave them with an angry word or something that's really ugly, because you may never get a chance to see them again. I've left people and they just weren't there the next day. And when you see people that aren't there the next day that you wish you had said something different to the day before, there's no way you can really make an amends for that. So the idea is, don't put yourself in a posture where you have to make an amends that you either don't want to make or you can't make in reality. And to live life very simply. And realize that everything is okay. Regardless of how it looks, it's okay. It's always been okay. And there's really nothing to work on, because it's already done. This is God's world. We're just as kids out here, and we're supposed to be enjoying playing in the garden. You know? And I like the kids, because I hang out with kids and they seem to know what's going on. You know, I remember one time watching a kid in an elevator, and I said, "Why are you scratching your head?" And he looked at me and he said, "Because I'm the only one who knows it itches." You know, kids have a way of keeping you right in the moment. And down where we had the international, down in the Seaport Village in 95, there's a little island there, man-made island, and the kids fly their kites there. And we get a lot of what they call June gloom, where the clouds are pretty low and you can't see the sun, but you know it's there and it's going to come out later. And I've seen kids fly their kites there. And I remember walking up to this lad who was about 9 years old, and his kite was above the clouds. And I said, "How do you know your kite is still there?" And he looked at me and he said, "'Cause I can feel the pull of it, mister." And in my life, I felt the pull of it. When I'm doing God's work, no one has to tell me, I feel the pull of it. And when I'm not, I feel the pull of that too. And I'm very thankful that I had an opportunity to spend this evening, this afternoon with Bob and you folks. And I love you very much, and please, please take real good care of one another, because we're only on loan. Thank you.